It's Encounter on the Voice of America. Encounter on the Voice of America brings together advocates and opponents debating the critical issues of our time in a freewheeling, no-holds-barred discussion of fact and opinion. With today's guests and the topic for Encounter, here is Carol Castiel.
Welcome to Encounter on the Voice of America. On this edition of the program, we revisit the menace of Boko Haram. Hello again, I'm Carol Castiel. In a speech marking the 15th anniversary of the end of military rule, Nigerian President Goodluck Jonathan has vowed to wage a total war against the militant Islamist group Boko Haram. He also said that his government will continue to do everything possible to bring home more than 200 schoolgirls who were kidnapped by the group last month. Despite promises of action from President Jonathan, Nigerian security forces have been unable to stop the increasingly frequent attacks, either claimed by or blamed on Boko Haram. In addition to the abduction of the schoolgirls, 130 people were killed by twin bombings in the city of Jos in late May. The Islamist radicals, whose name Boko Haram means Western education is a sin, have killed thousands of people over the past 5 years in attacks on schools, churches, mosques, bus stations, and other public places. But it was the high-profile and stunning abduction of the more than 200 schoolgirls from the hamlet of Chibok in northeast Nigeria in mid-April which grabbed international headlines and attracted international support. Foreign powers, including Britain, France, China, and the United States, put together a multilateral rescue mission. Washington has sent 80 soldiers to protect a base in Chad, from which it said it would send surveillance drones. However, in a wide-ranging foreign policy address last week, U.S. President Barack Obama said this about U.S. involvement in rescuing the kidnapped girls.
Now, tragically, no American security operation can eradicate the threat posed by an extremist group like Boko Haram, the group that kidnapped those girls. And that's why we have to focus not just on rescuing those girls right away, but also on supporting Nigerian efforts to educate its youth.
President Obama speaking at West Point Military Academy in New York. Well, for more on the roots and evolution of Boko Haram and the Nigerian government's approach to the threat, we turn to two distinguished analysts who are no strangers to these VOA microphones. J. Peter Pham is director of the Africa Center at the Atlantic Council, and that's a policy group based here in Washington, and Lauren Plock Blanchard. She's an Africa analyst at the Congressional Research Service. That's a legislative branch agency within the Library of Congress. And both panelists join me here at the VOA Broadcast Center in Washington. Welcome to you both.
Thank you, Carol.
Well, Peter Pham, let me begin with you. Your reaction to President Goodluck Jonathan's speech on this 15th anniversary of the end of military rule in Nigeria. What did you take away from that, especially vis-a-vis the attempts to rescue these girls and its approach to Boko Haram?
It shows how much still needs to be done in Nigeria. Nothing justifies the outrage that Boko Haram perpetrated by kidnapping these schoolgirls who were taking their exams. On the other hand, Boko Haram didn't arise in isolation. It grew up out of years of political, economic, social marginalization, neglect of most of the North, but in particular the northeastern part of Nigeria. It grew up out of a heavy-handed government attempt to quash it by force alone without dealing with basic questions of human security and development. And so it continues to feed off of these ineffectual, heavy-handed tactics on the part of the Nigerian government, one which has yet to really come to terms with the insurgency it's facing and the challenges which it needs to confront once and for all if it really is serious about ending this plague, which really has victimized Nigerians.
Turning to you, Lauren Plock Blanchard, for your reaction to the speech, and based on what Peter Pham just said, it doesn't sound like perhaps the Nigerian government quite gets it yet. This talk about a total war against terrorism doesn't seem to indicate that they understand that there are serious underlying problems. How do you see it?
This is a big question, you know, and it's something I think that international community has been asking itself since the kidnapping occurred, and certainly since the hashtag campaign and the social media focus has really drawn a lot of attention to the Nigerian government's or lack thereof to counter Boko Haram. And this is not to say that they haven't been putting extra forces up to the fight. They've had a joint task force operating in the north, I think, that dates back to about 2011. They enhanced it in 2013 when President Jonathan declared the state of emergency for the three states that have been most affected by Boko Haram operations. But we haven't necessarily seen the Nigerian military setting itself up for success up there. Their procurement over the last 5 or more years since Boko Haram's insurgency has really expanded and taken hold of the Northeast, they haven't been setting themselves up to fight a counterinsurgency campaign. They've been largely continuing to buy things and focus on their naval operations, for example, down in the Niger Delta, dealing with Niger Delta militancy prior to the amnesty, dealing with attacks that are ongoing against oil installations, kidnapping of oil workers. Obviously, they are still trying to maintain their peacekeeping operations abroad, but they haven't been necessarily doing the sorts of things and developing the sort of strategy that one needs to fight a counterinsurgency at home.
Back to you, Peter Pham. We've, of course, been talking about this problem at these microphones for years now, although it has now just sort of captured international attention here in the United States. Why do you think the Nigerian government has been unable to stop the growth and evolution of Boko Haram?
I think there are several factors, not one of which explains everything, but I think together they form a picture. One is President Goodluck Jonathan's agenda, insofar as a program for his administration, has been focused heavily on questions of development in terms of big projects, road building. And they've, to be fair to them, done a fairly credible job building a number of roads and highways, focusing on electrification, built power generation. So these are all good and well things, but the agenda is a domestically driven economic agenda. And there's a certain reason for it. Nigeria, with the rebasing of its GDP, has shown that it is actually Africa's largest economy. So there are reasons for this. There's been lack of attention, if you will, lack of interest in the security issues in the Niger Delta, which Lauren mentioned. Although there's a tenuous peace that's holding, the attention that was paid there a few years back has sort of dissipated. And certainly in the Northeast, where Boko Haram has been very active, the government has responded in a purely military fashion, hoping this problem can be cured very quickly and they can get back to the other business. And so I think that lack of attention is important. The other part is, let's be honest, the state where Boko Haram is most centered, Borno State, is a state that since the restoration of constitutional rule 15 years ago, has been always in the hands of the political opposition. So this is not where Jonathan's base is. In fact, the ruling party hasn't won a statewide race in that state for 15 years. I'm not saying that they're neglecting the population, but they're certainly, it's not their core constituency. And that has to factor into this. And then finally, there's the question of Nigeria's pride. Because it's the largest economy, it's the most populous country in Africa as well, there's a certain sense that they don't need the world to tell them what to do. They can fix their own problems. They just have to buy the right equipment, the right video cameras, the right drones, the right everything, and they can solve on their own. So there's a great reluctance to admit that they need a little bit of help from the outside.
Lauren Plock-Blanchard, anything to add or subtract to the reasons why heretofore the government has been just unable or unwilling to combat Boko Haram?
I think Peter's outlined a number of good points. A number of the policies that the president has been pushing in terms of power generation and expanding roads, expanding industry, these are all noble goals. They're not short-term goals that are going to address the insurgency. Unemployment is massive in the north, and particularly in the northeast, and that helps fuel some of this recruitment. When young men don't have any other opportunities, they look to other opportunities, including criminal activity, and some of that is what Boko Haram has been engaged in. You know, power generation is an extremely limiting factor on the ability to expand industry and jobs in the north. So until you can turn that around, and you are limited by corruption, and I'm not sure that this presidency has done enough to counter the grand scale state corruption that is limiting some of these major developments from going forward.
Back to you, Peter Pham. You mentioned pride. So I want to pick up on that because it's hard to believe that either the United States or other international actors haven't tried to discuss with the Nigerian government ways to combat Boko Haram other than just these military heavy-handed attacks. Now things seem to have changed. Do you think the government is in the throes of planning to change its strategy vis-a-vis the North, the economic development, providing employment, as President Obama said, more education?
Well, the government has made some noises in this direction. And they've said a few things that are the right things to say. But I think the proof is what many of us are waiting for, the real deeds, the implementation. If one goes back just 2 months, Carol, the kidnapping occurred in the middle of April. It was several weeks before President Goodluck Jonathan even acknowledged the fact that this had occurred. And then there were some very unhelpful things that were said by the First Lady of Nigeria that were not especially helpful in the circumstance. And it was only after the international, global, really, social media campaign that Nigeria was essentially shamed into accepting help. Although now that they've been pressured into it, the claim is that they always have been asking for help, and it's about time the international community came to them, but that's not reality-based. And so I think we really have to see whether these are just noises being made or if there's been a true change of heart.
Lauren Plug Blanchard, anything to add or subtract with regard to the Nigerian government? Do you see any kind of shift as a result of this crisis?
I think we've seen some positive statements made by some individuals in the Jonathan administration. The National Security Advisor back in March outlined a new, softer approach that the Nigerian government was developing to counter Boko Haram. Counter-radicalization programs, prison reforms, a number of things that civil society groups and international donors had been calling for quite a while. I think that was a positive sign. It was positively received by the U.S. government and others. The proof will be, of course, in the pudding. And I think there is still somewhat of a question about how much influence President Jonathan and his national security advisor actually have with the military commanders that are operating on the ground in the Northeast. Do they have the ability to curb these abuses and change the tactics that the Nigerian military has been using in the Northeast, which are widely considered to be counterproductive and sort of potentially fueling recruitment and support for Boko Haram in some of these areas?
You're listening to Encounter on The Voice of America. My guests are J. Peter Pham. He's director of the Africa Center at the Atlantic Council. That's a policy group based in Washington. And Lauren Plug Blanchard, from whom you just heard. She's an Africa analyst at the Congressional Research Service. That's within the Library of Congress. And we're talking about the short and long-term strategies to address the threat from the Nigerian-based terrorist group Boko Haram. This is a reminder that you can listen to Encounter online as a podcast. Please visit our website at voanews.com/encounter. And as always, we love to hear from you, so keep those emails coming to encounter@voanews.com. And here's a big shout-out to one of our most loyal listeners, Ambrose Ajio from Benue State, Nigeria. Well, back to you, Peter Pham, to talk about now Boko Haram and its evolution, its origins, to what extent it has morphed into something much larger than it originally was meant to be. Talk about how it got to be so much more lethal and its, you know, international ties with other Al-Qaeda-linked groups.
I kind of like to look at Boko Haram and say that it's gone through two and maybe three phases. There was the phase up to 2009 where it was primarily a local group confined to northeastern Nigeria. Its agenda was largely to transform Nigeria into its version of Islam and a Sharia compliant according to its interpretation of Islam. And for a period of time, actually, in the early 2000s, the founder of Boko Haram, Muhammad Yusuf, actually had a tactical alliance with some of the politicians in Borno State, especially the governor at the time, Ali Modi Sharif. Then there was a falling out in the governor's second term. And at that time, a number of incidents escalated, and the Nigerian military moved in 2009 to crush Boko Haram. Several hundred members were killed. Muhammad Yusuf was killed, extrajudicially executed while in police custody, and everyone proclaimed the group gone. In fact, there were several dozen survivors, including Abubakar Shekau, the current leader of Boko Haram. They linked up with Al-Qaeda and the Islamic Maghreb, the North African branch of Al-Qaeda, received shelter, some support, some training, possibly also some training as far east as Somalia and territory held by Al-Shabaab, and came back in version, what I call version 2.0. Boko Haram with more an ideology closer in conformity with extremist Salafism, a greater tactical capability for things like suicide bombings, which it introduced into Nigeria for the first time in 2011, attacking both the superintendent of the national police as well as UN headquarters. And then there's the period after 2012 when Islamist militants seized control of northern Mali, and there's evidence that Boko Haram had training camps up in northern Mali. And that's the version we're now seeing, a group that's not only a terrorist group, but one which increasingly is able to carry out a classic insurgency, especially outside the cities, but also attacking some towns and city centers in northeastern Nigeria, a much more sophisticated tactically group.
Turning to you, Lauren Plug Blanchard, obviously Boko Haram has morphed into a much more serious organization, and one can perhaps, in retrospect, partly blame the Nigerian government for not dealing with it early on or for mishandling or because of its heavy-handed tactics. But we are where we are, and because of its affiliation now with al-Qaeda groups, with AQIM and al-Shabaab and sophisticated tactics, how are we going to address the problem?
It's a really good question, and it goes to how much we know about the group, and I would argue we don't know nearly enough. We know that they have some safe havens in which they operate within northern Nigeria, particularly within Borno State. They also operate in undergoverned areas along the border of Cameroon, Chad, and southern Niger, and they're able to, depending on Nigerian security force operations, flee to those areas across the border when necessary. But at the moment, they do appear to be operating out of some significant territory within Borno State. So for Nigerian security forces, shrinking that safe haven territory is going to be sort of a primary task, but it's going to require quite a bit of cooperation with the neighboring countries. And we've seen some enhanced engagement from particularly Cameroon, just announced that it was deploying an additional 1,000 forces. It's already got a special forces unit known as the BIR that's operating up in the area where Boko Haram is believed to operate. Cameroon, Niger, and Chad, their capability in terms of intelligence gathering is fairly limited, and we've seen that Boko Haram has been able to recruit within some of these bordering communities. So the ability for Boko Haram to be able to fall back to some of these areas is going to make it a lot more challenging to root the group. Also, their ability to fall back to some of the areas farther north in the Sahel and link up and get support from AQIM makes it a challenge. Can they be degraded? Absolutely. Can they be defeated in the short term? I think that's a big if.
Turning back to you, Peter Pham, what about the international cooperation that the kidnapping of these girls has attracted? How much of a difference will this make in your view?
Well, it certainly is helpful to, especially the deployment by President Obama of an unarmed predator drone to Chad, which will overfly northern Nigeria. The Nigerians themselves, actually several years ago, purchased a number of UAVs from Israel, but they didn't maintain them, so none of them currently fly. So it's a contribution of capability, the surveillance, intelligence fusion, which the US, the UK, and France are pooling their intelligence, sharing it. The problem, however, is partners on the other side. We've got two major issues. One is because of legislative requirements, the law here in the United States, we can't be directly cooperating or supplying assistance to units which may be implicated credibly in human rights abuses, which include a number of units in the Nigerian military. So that's an issue. It's being overcome by the training of carefully vetted unit, but that's going to take a bit of time. In the meantime, you've got also undisciplined troops in Nigeria. The 7th Nigerian Division, which is spearheading the military fight against Boko Haram in Borno State, just several weeks ago, mutinied against the commanding 2-star general, fired at him, soldiers of that division, and the government hastily had to cashier him and replace him with someone else. So that unit, which is supposedly fighting the terrorists, has now on its 4th commander since the beginning of the year. That type of lack of continuity certainly degrades capacity. So part of the issue is going to be finding an able and willing partner.
And Lauren Plug Blanchard, what are your thoughts with respect to the stepped-up international assistance, how much of a difference this is going to make, and, you know, what the kidnapping of these girls and the commitment of other heinous acts by Boko Haram, what does it say, really, about the credibility of Nigeria's police and military?
You know, I think the proof will be in the pudding, I guess, so to speak. The United States, the Brits, the French have all offered some significant assistance, particularly the United States has put a team up almost 30 people. The military component of that is about 16 people right now. And they're offering, you know, to advise mobilize and assist in the search and planning potentially of rescue operations. But of course, you know, most experts would suggest that a rescue attempt for these girls is going to be extremely dangerous. And I think everybody needs to have realistic expectations here. We're talking about over 200 girls. They've likely been split up. The chances of conducting a successful rescue operation of one group of those girls may result in the others being killed. Hostage rescue attempts by joint forces, Brits and the French, have been engaged with the Nigerians in efforts to rescue their own citizens who have been kidnapped by Boko Haram and its splinter group in Saro in the past. They haven't gone well. They've resulted in the death of the hostages. Boko Haram has assassinated hostages when it's even gotten a hint of a rescue operation. So I think, you know, that's a very dangerous path, and a lot of people have been advising the Nigerian government, and they seem to be taking it to heart, that negotiations may be the best path. Now, the United States has been advising against negotiations that would result in, say, a prisoner swap and letting out sort of terrorists in exchange for these girls. So we'll see what exactly these negotiations may lead to. And I think in terms of the credibility of the Nigerian military, some of these potential command changes could have some positive benefits. It was clear that morale was very low within the 7th Division. It sort of seems to have prompted this latest mutiny attempt. It wasn't the first mutiny attempt. So whether or not they can improve their management as they go forward, I think, is something that we're all going to be looking forward to seeing.
Peter Pham, what about negotiations, a prisoner swap or whatever, something short of a rescue attempt, which could, as Lauren said, be very risky? What other options are there to bring this to an end and then to deal with Boko Haram on a more holistic level?
Well, we've talked a lot about the responsibilities of the Nigerian government, and certainly as the lawful government of the country, a great deal of the onus lies on it. However, we shouldn't underestimate the threat that this group now poses. Just as it's complicated to rescue more than 200 girls, it was quite an operation, objectively speaking, to have seized that many girls. It takes a bit of organization, which means this group, which just a few years ago was doing drive-by shootings, is now capable of organizing itself to carry out the dastardly deed. So we're not dealing with amateurs anymore. We're dealing with lethal professionals. And so that has to be taken into consideration when we talk about negotiating. Negotiating with them may get these girls, the specific group, freed. But then what happens the next time the government captures some Boko Haram terrorists? Do they go out and pick up another group of innocent people to trade them? And they're already seizing people, not just in Nigeria, but abroad. 2 weeks ago, a group of Chinese workers working in northern Cameroon near Waza, which is just about 12 miles from the Nigerian border, were seized and presumably taken by Boko Haram. At least all the evidence seems to indicate that. So they're crossing borders and seizing other hostages. So it's a dilemma. There's no easy answer.
One more question to you. In terms of Boko Haram, obviously it has become much more lethal for the many reasons you've both articulated. Do you see any factions within Boko Haram that can be dealt with, that the Nigerian government can deal with or somehow co-opt? Again, looking at the long run, any grievances that can be addressed and then could weaken the organization?
I think this has to be approached holistically. First, the Nigerian government has to provide security for its own people. That's the beginning of any counterinsurgency. When you secure the civilian population, then you begin to get information from them. That helps you to begin to degrade the group. And you have to provide development, jobs, opportunities, all those things. That takes time. In the short term, we need to gather more intelligence. We're not up to speed on Boko Haram. We don't know as much, as Lauren said, as we ought to.
The United States,
but the same with the Nigerians. They haven't shown, at least, the analytical capability to. And there are indications, at least anecdotally, that there are divisions and fissures within Boko Haram that might be exploitable, but we need to know more. Uh-huh. And building that base of information is critical. So better intelligence and better security working hand in hand, and then part of a broader strategy.
And the last word to you, Lauren, you're an expert on Boko Haram. Do you see any divisions within the group? It's not a monolithic organization anymore. Do you see ways of exploiting differences, separating the more radicals away from those who maybe have legitimate grievances but have turned to deadly tactics because they have yet to get a response for their grievances from the government?
I think it's difficult to figure out exactly how you separate the more extreme and the more internationally focused elements from the more locally focused. They seem to be becoming more internationally focused. Shekau Bello's statements, you know, his public statements, his videos, they show a greater level of sophistication than we've seen in the past. He's speaking in multiple languages. He's speaking in Hausa to the local communities. He's speaking in Arabic, and he's also now throwing in a few English sentences. So he's clearly trying to reach a broader audience. You know, we've seen fissures in the group in the past, the development of Ansaru back in 2012. Shekau seems to have dealt pretty brutally with people that he saw as trying to break away. He reportedly tipped off the Nigerian security forces, and a number of cell leaders, including those linked with Ansaru, were killed back in 2012. And some of the Ansaru leaders seem to have since then sort of reunited with Shekau, notably Khalid al-Barnawi, who was seen as really a key link to AQIM. And I think, you know, moving forward, the Nigerians, the United States, the international community, those collecting intelligence on the group really need to pay a lot more attention to those international linkages, to the elements of Boko Haram that are liaising with AQIM and the affiliated groups in both northern Mali and operating as far north as Libya. We need to figure out more about what's going on in the Lake Chad Basin area with Boko Haram. There's rumors and allegations of links between Boko Haram leaders and Seleka. You know, I don't think those have been corroborated yet, but they're worrying, and there is talk of Boko Haram presence and travel through Sudan. Those things need to be watched very carefully as we see sort of whether or not Boko Haram decides to turn its eyes away from Borno State, where clearly they've borne the brunt of Boko Haram violence so far. You know, we haven't seen major attacks, deadly attacks on international targets really since the 2011 UN bombing in Abuja. Kidnappings are one thing, but are we going to see more attacks on international installations, Western installations in West Africa going forward?
Certainly, Boko Haram, a local, regional, and now an international problem. I'm afraid that's all the time we have on this edition of Encounter. We will be tracking events in Nigeria regarding efforts to combat Boko Haram in the weeks ahead. I'd like to thank my guests, J. Peter Pham, director of the Africa Center at the Atlantic Council, and Lauren Pluck Blanchard, an Africa analyst at the U.S. Congressional Research Service of the Library of Congress. Thanks so much for your terrific insights. Thanks to Anna Zalewski for booking our guests. Our engineer was Vasco Volorich. And I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Encounter on The Voice of America.
Encounter on The Voice of America. Encounter on The Voice of America brought together advocates and opponents debating the critical issues of our time in a freewheeling, no-holds-barred discussion of fact and opinion. Your host was Carol Castiel. Join us again next week for another Encounter on The Voice of America.